Hello, everyone. Jonathan Groner here, host of the Wayward Pilot Podcast. I'm a certificated flight instructor and commercial pilot. We have new episodes of the podcast every Friday where we talk about general aviation, flight training. We have interviews with fellow aviators, and we take your questions on the podcast. Anything you want to know about general aviation or flight training. You can find the podcast on Apple Podcast as well as follow us on Instagram at Wayward Pilot. And please check out waywardpilot.com for more information about the show.
Are you a pilot, student pilot, or aviation enthusiast? You've come to the right place. Take your seat, fasten your seatbelt, and get ready for takeoff. With the Wayward Pilot Podcast, your number one source for information about flight training, travel, safety, and leisure in the aviation industry. You are now cleared for takeoff. And here is your captain, FAA certificated Gold Seal flight instructor and commercial pilot, Jonathan Groner.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Wayward Pilot Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Groner. Thanks for being with us again today. I figured after a few episodes of talking with guests and sharing some of their experience that I thought I'd share a little bit of my own experience and kind of how I got into aviation and a little bit of some of the things I've been through on the way down this road to CFI and working as a commercial pilot. So as I mentioned before on a previous episode of the podcast, I got interested in aviation at a pretty young age. I was living in Topsom, Maine, which is right next to Brunswick, and Brunswick has a Naval Air Station, or had a Naval Air Station there, where they actually had a lot of P-3 Orions based, and they would do some surveillance of the coastal waters in that area. It was really kind of cool to watch them fly over the house, because our house was situated kind of right at the end of the runway, or one of the runways there at the air station, and every year they'd hold the Great State of Maine Air Show there. And you get to see all kinds of things, like the Blue Angels would come by, of course, and a lot of demonstrations, different aerobatic pilots. And I actually got a chance to meet Patty Wagstaff there, probably about the age of 7 or 8 at that time. I think it was about 1990 or so. So naturally, I was hooked on aviation after being exposed to that so much. And my mother and father had found an after-school program, and the program was kind of like a private pilot ground school for kids. There was two courses. There's a basic and advanced course. And in the basic course, you learn all the things you need to know about aerodynamics and four forces of flight and, you know, how airplane operates and that kind of thing. And then at the culmination of that, I think it was about 5 or 6 different weekends, we would go up to a place in Maine called Twitchell Field, which still exists, and they paired us with some other flight instructors. I just kind of viewed them as like these gods of aviation who knew how to do everything. And they let us sit in the front seat, kind of like on a discovery flight, like what you might be used to for a discovery flight. And we got an opportunity to take the controls and fly around a little bit. And, you know, they showed us basically one takeoff, one landing. And I was just hooked from that point. I think my father had rented a VHS camcorder for the event, because we didn't have one ourselves. We decided to rent one, and I must have watched that recording of the flight and me leaving on the airplane like over and over and over again. I was completely hooked. And of course, I was influenced by some of the movies at the time, like Top Gun and things like that. So I think I was originally thinking I was going to head into a naval aviation kind of thing. Of course, that changed much later on, but I really, really was enthralled by naval aviators, and I really wanted to get into that as a kid, like really young, not really thinking too much about it, just those dreams that you have as a kid. So then eventually I'd moved a couple times back and forth from Maine to Virginia, and mostly had to do with my father being in the shipbuilding industry as an engineer, and a lot of the ports in Maine for shipbuilding, and in Norfolk for where the naval ships and stuff would dock. So I moved around a little bit, but only usually between those two states. And then I eventually went to high school and graduated high school just outside of D.C. In Fairfax County, Virginia. And immediately after that, I joined the Army. And at that time, I had gotten into the idea that I wanted to be in law enforcement. And I'd actually taken some criminal justice classes in high school, but I was also in Army JROTC in high school. And I kind of enjoyed both aspects of the military and law enforcement. So naturally, I went right off and enlisted into the Army as an MP. So right after graduation or thereabouts, I was shipped off to basic training in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, and went to basic training there and MP school. And then at that time, I'd also learned about a unit in the Army called the Old Guard. The Mule Guard is the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment. It's the Army's official ceremonial unit and escort to the president, and they're located at Fort Myer and Fort McNair, actually, in Arlington, Virginia. And they do a lot of the funerals in Arlington Cemetery. Of course, they guard the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, the responsibilities for that. They do ceremonies for general retirements. They do a thing called Twilight Tattoo in front of the Ellipse, in front of the White House in the summertime. And then they do a show that kind of travels around, also called Spirit of America, or they used to. I don't know if they still do that or not. But I was kind of enthralled with that, and I decided, hey, I want to do that too. So naturally, I asked to be assigned in that unit, and they asked for some information, and they asked for a photo of you in uniform, and then they select you to go to that unit. So I got selected. So I went off to my first duty station, which was Fort Myer, Virginia. So I ended up right back kind of home where I was before. I didn't have to move too far. Went through that, did some cool things there. Actually had an opportunity to stand guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, which was an amazing experience. I didn't end up staying there very long. And then ended up getting deployed actually to the Horn of Africa as part of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, and enjoyed that immensely, the experience of it anyway. Didn't necessarily enjoy being deployed immensely, but enjoyed the experience of it and the people I met. And that was kind of about the time when I was getting ready to leave the Army to end my terms of service, or ETS, and I had to think about what I wanted to do. So I had naturally thought about continuing my career in law enforcement and decided to apply to the Virginia State Police. And I did get hired by the Virginia State Police, and I went to the State Police Academy in Virginia, in Richmond, Virginia. And the training in Richmond takes about, I'd say it probably takes about 8 to 9 months. So it's a pretty grueling process. You stay there during the week and you go home on the weekends. And I hadn't given much thought to flying since my earlier days. I had thought of it as, you know, kind of a hobby, something I still wanted to do. But I also didn't have a lot of funds to make it happen. So eventually, as these things do, I started to get my interest back into aviation as kind of a hobby, and thought about going on to flight training, trying to figure out how to pay for it. It was about that time that I was approached and asked if I would like to be a part of the Virginia State Police Aviation Unit as a FLIR operator. FLIR, forward-looking infrared radar. So basically, as an operator, I would sit in the front of our Bell 407 next to the pilot. I would operate the FLIR system and use it for search and rescue and law enforcement operations. It basically sees heat. So it sees differences in heat or difference in infrared wavelengths. So you can look down in a pretty thick forest and kind of tell if someone is moving down there, or looking for someone who's lost in the woods or in a river or something like that. Or even if we're looking for a suspect in a crime, you can kind of see a lot better as opposed to night vision, which is just amplifying the light. We're actually looking at the heat signatures on the ground. And it was really cool technology, and it didn't take long to get trained in it. And I was really honored to be selected to do that. So I did that for quite a while, probably 4 or 5 months before I thought, hey, I'd really like to get back into flying. And it was great because the pilots there were very encouraging about me getting back into flying, and they kind of mentored me through that process. And so eventually, when I did start to take lessons, I always had someone to kind of look to and ask questions of. And even though they were helicopter pilots, all of the pilots with the State Police Aviation Unit were dual rated in both airplane and helicopter. And I actually got to fly in some of the airplanes because they did speed enforcement in the airplanes as well. If you've ever driven in Virginia, you've seen the signs that say speed checked by aircraft. That's totally true. They actually did do that. I don't know if they do it anymore. It's kind of prohibitively expensive. But they would check your speed in a Cessna 182 with a trooper sitting in the back, running some equipment. That was kind of neat. And just doing some cool things with aviation unit really spurred that interest again in aviation, and I decided to go off for it. And so as I was going through flight training, I learned that if you were a trooper, you were already a law enforcement officer, and you had a pilot certificate for an airplane, you were eligible to apply to the aviation unit as a pilot trainee. And they would essentially pay for all of your ratings. So they would pay for everything from airplane instrument to commercial airplane to private helicopter, commercial helicopter, instrument helicopter. And then they would send you off to Bell to get the specific 407 training as well. And they would pay for that. And you would get paid as a trooper for your regular duties while you're doing that. And I thought that sounded like a great idea. I mean, that's probably over $100,000 worth of training. That's probably a light estimate or conservative estimate. So naturally, I had my sights set on that goal, and I was really looking forward to doing that. Started working through everything, and then the day came, I finally got my private pilot certificate. I had gone through a Part 61 school, that may be Part 141 now, called Aviation Adventures in Manassas, Virginia. I highly recommend it. They have three locations now. I've been keeping up with one of the owners and the chief pilot, Bob, for a while. At the time, they only had one or two locations, but I think they've expanded to a third at this point. Really top-notch flight school. I believe they've been voted number one in the country a couple times, if not number one, pretty high up there in that list by AOPA. And I can't thank them enough for kind of helping me along that path. It wasn't cheap, as most things in aviation aren't. And I definitely had some help from my mother, who helped me foot some of the bill for some of the flight training at the time. Troopers during the time didn't make a whole lot of money to start out with. I think I started about $35,000 to $40,000, and that just wasn't going to cover it for flight training, which ended up costing about $10,000 by the time I finished, which is actually pretty good. But you know, these days you can actually be had a private pilot certificate can actually be had a lot cheaper than that. So it's funny though, even though I was in the mode at that point, I was doing what I wanted to do. I definitely got discouraged halfway through training, as I think some people may find they do in their training. And I almost stopped. I almost quit flying because of how discouraged I was getting. I had a really good and really enthusiastic flight instructor in the beginning. His name, I'm going to call him out. His name is Patrick Magumbwa. He was just really enthusiastic, really supportive, always calling to make sure that I was scheduling more lessons and sticking with the program and studying and things like that. And he really put forth a lot of effort. And he left the flight school midway through my training and started to go off and pursue his dream, which is flying for airlines. And I think he's still flying for the airlines right now. And Patrick flies for a airline outside of the U.S., and he seems like he's having the time of his life. He's been doing it for quite a long time now. I believe he just got upgraded to captain on some pretty big equipment, so we're all excited for him. But after Patrick left, things kind of took a turn. I got assigned an instructor, or I got hooked up with an instructor who I didn't really get along with. Not that he was doing anything wrong. He just wasn't kind of my type of person. Our personalities didn't mesh well. And I think back then, if someone had said, hey, you know, you don't have to go with that instructor, you can go with a different instructor, or you can find an instructor who meshes more with your personality, that would have stopped some of the things that happened afterwards. But I started to cancel lessons, and then I started to just forget about lessons that I had on the schedule because they weren't a priority in my mind. It wasn't something that I was looking forward to. So therefore, I put it kind of to the back burner. And it was unfortunate because it's not the type of person I wanted to be as a student. And it's definitely wasn't conducive to finishing my private pilot certificate, especially that someone was helping me pay for. And I knew that was disappointing to them as well. So I kind of muddled my way along. And over the next couple of months, I decided that I just wasn't sure if I wanted to do this. I had soloed. I had done some of my requirements to finish. I had not done my solo cross country. But I just wasn't motivated to do it. And I remember I'd taken a photo of myself while I was doing a short cross country in the airplane, or a local flight in the airplane. And I was thinking to myself, well, you know, I did it. I soloed, right? And, you know, I can say I've flown. I don't really need to get the certificate to say that I finished or I couldn't do it. But I think that was kind of a hazardous attitude on my part, because I just kind of was giving up. I was resigning myself to the fact that this wasn't going to happen. And I don't know if I had reached out. I don't believe I did. I don't believe I reached out to anybody and said, you know, the struggles I was having. But I think one of the instructors took it on themselves. We had an instructor there. I believe his name was Josh Harnagle. And if he's out there, it'd be really cool to talk to him sometime. But Josh was extremely busy instructor. I couldn't get on his schedule. He was a great instructor, and that's probably why, obviously. And he found a gap in his time and noticed that I wasn't booking lessons anymore. And we had chatted before, so he knew who I was. We got along pretty well. But I didn't know that he was really available for any instruction because he was always so busy. Well, Josh reached out to me and he said, look, John, you know, we got to get you done. Let's go fly. Let's get some lessons on the schedule and get you done. And so that's what we did. And Josh showed me some things that I'd never been shown before and really made some of the lessons click in my mind and really, really prepared me for my private pilot check ride. And he was the one who eventually signed me off, even though I kind of forget that he was there at the end because my most of my training was done with Patrick. But Josh was really the one who got me finished and made sure that I completed this goal in my life to get my private pilot certificate. So he signed me off for my check ride, and I took that, and it was a great experience. Can't say too much about it. It was a pretty basic check ride. Great examiner, Jerry Kanoff. I believe he's still teaching out of Shannon in Fredericksburg area of Virginia. Great examiner, very professional. Had a great time during the check ride. It was challenging for sure, and I was very, very nervous, but we chatted quite a bit and had a good experience out of it, and I walked away with a private pilot certificate, and I couldn't have been more happy. But at the time, it was still a hobby and couldn't really do anything with it. And the interesting thing is I earned my certificate and then waited to see when there was going to be opening with the state police in their aviation unit, and lo and behold, the state ran out of funding for the aviation base in my area, and they shut down. They actually did advertise for pilot positions, too, but they advertised for them in Richmond, Virginia, and I actually couldn't afford to move to Richmond because I just purchased a house at that side of D.C., and if you're not local to the D.C. area, real estate there can be incredibly expensive, and troopers in the area actually make 25% more than they do in the rest of the state. So to leave to go to Richmond would actually be taking a pay cut to become a pilot, and I just couldn't afford to do that. So I decided to move on and continue my career in law enforcement, actually became an investigator, a special agent with the state police, and was investigating violent crimes and homicides, was a crime scene investigator and a bloodstain pattern analyst, and I could go on and on and on about all that for days and days. That's a whole other part of my life that I'm sure not everybody here is interested in, but it was a good experience, and I had fun doing it. So it's so much like me to kind of find some new thing that I want to do and try to excel at it. And for me, it was that I wanted to open a business. And I decided to open this business around the time that I was working as an investigator. And I went through all the normal steps that you would go through to open a business. And, you know, I had a partner and I was forming a LLC and getting funding and loans from a bank. And we had a space and we're building out and doing all these things. And, you know, it ended up being a really tough time for me. The business was a kind of miserable failure. And I had so much time and money and other people's money invested into this business that it was really kind of heartbreaking to see it fail so horribly. But it probably went on for about a year and a half to 2 years total time. I think the business was only open for about a year before things started to fall apart. High overhead cost, a large amount of debt, not quite enough money coming in, not the right market for it. We had a lot of people pop up in the market at the same time as we did, and where we thought that originally we were going to be the only person in the market, it turned out to be where we were one of five other people in the market at the same time. And it just didn't end up well. And I think that it was worth going for. I think it was worth going after. And I learned a lot about business. I like to joke that I got my MBA in the School of Hard Knocks because that's really what it was. I mean, opening and having a business shuttered and basically losing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars to a business that, and you know, to be perfectly candid, that has just been now paid off so that we're free and clear of it after what's like over 3 years is definitely a big hard life lesson. But I think I needed to do that to learn some things about myself and learn about what I'm capable of, but at the same time to, you know, kind of put me down the path that I am now. And when the business ended, we ended up moving out of state because why not? My wife's business is online and we don't need to be tied down to any location specifically. So we decided to move closer to the beach. And so here we are in Wilmington, North Carolina, where it's beautiful and sunny all the time, right? Actually, it's kind of stormy today. But as we decided to move down here, I realized that I needed to find something else to do. I just come out of a pretty long career in law enforcement and I had all the credentials and I could go back into that for sure. But part of me just didn't want to. I didn't really have the desire to do that. So I kind of messed around and tried some things online that didn't work out well. But I kind of kept going back to my real passion is flying. During this whole time, I'd always flown as a hobbyist, although not very much. I think I amassed a whopping 100 hours over the 10 years from 2008 to 2018, 2008 being when I got my private pilot certificate. And it was just a hobby. I hadn't really flown much or felt like I was very, very proficient or very current at all, even though I'd done my flight reviews and things like that. But eventually, and whether it was because I looked so miserable, bored around the house, or because my wife just wanted me to get out of it, it was suggested to me that I go off and go back to school and get my commercial pilot certificate and get my instructor certificates and kind of shoot for a possibility of an airline career or some kind of commercial career in aviation. And it didn't take much. I think the first suggestion of that, I was pretty much out the door, but it didn't take much for me to go ahead and decide to go out and do that. So I did some research and I looked around at local flight schools, which we really didn't have a local flight school in Wilmington at the time. And I looked at some other ones that were close by and tried to decide what was the most economical way to do it, what was the fastest way to do it. I eventually settled on ATP Flight School in Raleigh. And we talk a lot about ATP. We make fun of ATP. It's good to poke fun at them sometimes. They are very expensive, but they are also very fast. You can get through the program very quickly. And that was important to me because I have two children and my wife. And while I was doing all this training, she would be home kind of taking care of the kids. And she doesn't mind doing that for the most part, but it's when I'm gone that things tend to kind of go haywire. So me being gone for an extended period of time was kind of like not really a possibility. So I rolled in ATP and we actually borrowed a camper from her late father, my father-in-law. And I actually took the camper from New York State and brought it down to Wilmington, got it ready and brought it up to Raleigh, actually Durham, North Carolina, where I parked in a kind of a trailer park, a campground thing. It was called a campground, but it had a lot of permanent visitors, if you get my drift. Some people had a camper with like a deck built outside of it. So I parked in my spot there and I would stay in the camper Monday through Friday, and I would come home Saturday, Sunday. So I flew usually twice a day, Monday through Friday, slept in the camper, and then would drive home and then stay at home and reconnect with the family and the wife. And then I would come back to the flight school the following day. So that was an interesting experience, to say the least. It was definitely mentally taxing. It was physically taxing. The drive back and forth was draining. You know, it's 2.5 hours each way, two times a week, which is, you know, not too bad if you think about a week-long commute. But at the same time, I was also driving back and forth to the airport, which took 20 to 30 minutes every day, and doing all the flight training and everything too, and trying to study on my own, alone in the woods, without kind of any support out there. It was kind of interesting. But we stayed connected by phone and everything, and it ended up working out pretty well. And I had a good time with the people I met there. Going to ATP was an interesting experience for me because I, at the time, was 35 years old. Most of the people there, I would say, were quite a bit younger, although I got lucky. And I think that the group that I interacted with was very mature. And at least two or three of the folks that I was working with were around my same age or studying with were around my same age. And that really made it kind of nice because it felt like I wasn't alone, like this older adult going through this training program, trying to fit in with the young people. So I was actually able to fit in pretty well with both young and old, and we got along pretty well. And we talked a little bit about the ATP experience on here with Aaron Weems and some other folks. And I think that environment there was just like this special kind of group that I fell in with. I don't think that you're going to find that everywhere. I think we're very lucky to have that. And we all still talk to this day on a daily basis about where we are in aviation, about what jobs we're doing, about the struggles that we're going through with the coronavirus deal. Almost all of the people who were in my group who were looking at airline jobs are now got that put on hold, which is unfortunate. And we're hoping for something better for them very soon. But we all get to share that with each other, and we've all supported each other through that, and it's been kind of good. So the biggest thing I remember about going to this program at ATP and training was that I was 100 hours, which is required, private pilot with no instrument rating. And I met up with my instructor, Eric Wilcox, who's really awesome. I had a great time with him. Eric was my age. He was recently retired from the Army, and he was just a phenomenal instructor, and I really got along with him really well. I think we had a lot of common experience, which is, you know, one of those things that instructors try to find with their students. And then we were just, because of age and time in our lives and life experiences and the fact you're both in the military, I think that played well into kind of our relationship, and it just really worked really well. And he was a great instructor, and I learned a lot from him. So here I am starting instrument training. It's a very, very intense program. The idea was that they already had the checkride scheduled. The checkride was scheduled for like 4 weeks out from when I started. And that immediately scared me, just to think they've got this checkride. And not just because it's a checkride, but because I haven't taken a checkride in 10 years. I forget how they work and everything. So I do a lot of research on that as well, just to remember for myself kind of how this whole thing works. I don't come in, a lot of people who start zero time at ATP, they have the advantage of going through the program and being exposed to it all at one time. You know, I have this 10-year gap kind of where I haven't really been flying and I haven't really been talking about checkrides or training or understanding those regulations or even thinking about instrument training. It wasn't new, but it was definitely rusty. So we get in instrument training and we're flying two times a day. And we're knocking all the requirements out, and I'm having a good time, and I'm starting to pick it up, and I'm understanding, I'm studying at night, I don't have any distractions from anything. I'm just kind of going home to my camper and studying, and which was great. But then the checkride came, and this is something that I like to talk about with my students, because I want them to understand that they're not alone in these experiences, that everybody struggles with stuff. And everybody has setbacks and things like that. But we got to the checkride time, and I felt very prepared. And I knew that I had the knowledge I needed, but I was still incredibly nervous. I can't even tell you how nervous I was. I was up all night long, probably got 3-4 hours of sleep, which probably played more into the events that followed. I had these nightmares about failing the checkride for, you know, various reasons, all of which was ridiculous. Like the things that I thought I was going to fail for, you know, there's no way I could not have known that information that I was being quizzed on. So I woke up not feeling very good, got to the airport, a couple hours early, was filling out weight and balance and performance charts, you know, just in case I wanted to see those, and, my cross-country flight plan that I was asked to plan, and looking at weather, and decided on a go, no-go decision based on the trip that they had asked me to plan, the examiner had asked me to plan, because, of course, that was going to be one of the things they're going to ask you, right? You know, are you going to go on this cross-country trip with a new instrument rating? And the answer to mine was no, just because some of the weather had moved into the area. But we actually had to fly to the checkride, which was nice to get a little bit of a refresher on the way there, shoot an approach on the way in, kind of get warmed up and everything. And we land at the field and get ready to go to my checkride. And I remember meeting the examiner. And this particular examiner was very well known for being very fair and very thorough. And that was fine. He's also very well known for having a straight face the entire time. You can't really know if you're doing well or not doing well, or, you know, and he'll tell you, and that's fair. He'll tell you that you haven't failed unless I've said you failed, which is great. But I'd still like to know how I'm doing by some expression or something like that. And, you know, a smile every once in a while would be interesting to see. But that's fair. I mean, it's very objective. I think the check ride was fair, and I don't think there's anything wrong with, you know, playing a straight face and just looking at the different things that they're required to look at as part of the ACS or PTS, whatever the case may be in your situation. Not all of the tests have moved over to ACS. Some of them are still PTS. So looking at those testing standards, objectively is fine. I just felt like I need a little more personality, a little bit of maybe some laughing and joking to kind of ease the mood. But he didn't make it overly uncomfortable either. It was just kind of neutral, which is fine. I don't have a problem with that. So we got checked into the check ride, gave him all my information, introduced each other, chatted a little bit. Very, very little bit about training, very, very little bit about what I was doing in training, maybe less than 30 seconds or so, and moved right into the questioning portion. And this examiner is very efficient. He gets right to the point and gets right to the questions. And we went through low and route charts and approach plates and weather minimums and alternate minimums and IFR regulations and required reports and compass errors and reading weather charts and identifying different symbols on the charts and things like that. And probably got through that in about 25 to 30 minutes. And it may have been longer than that, but it certainly felt like a pretty short amount of time. But I don't think I missed a beat. There was one question where I saw him write something down and I got the impression that I might answer it incorrectly, but it wasn't addressed again, so I'm not really sure. But it was like the smoothest, to me, the easiest oral exam portion of a practical test that I've ever taken. Of course, I've only taken two at that point, but to this day, I think it was the smoothest and fastest one I've ever had. And it was because he stuck just to the questions, and I answered the questions, and I believe I answered them correctly and concisely. And I think that really did a lot to impress him. And he did say later on that he was very impressed by my oral exam and that I did very well. And that he didn't have any problems with it. And whatever it was that he wrote down, he didn't bring up again. So whatever that was, either wasn't that important or he forgot about it or something like that. So I felt really good about that part. The flying portion didn't go as well. And part of that might have been it's all my own fault. But part of that may have been because of the day I chose to do the exam. It was extremely windy. Not an issue as far as landing. The winds were blowing right down the runway, but it was extremely windy, extremely turbulent. It was very, very difficult to control the airplane precisely that day. And even at the end of the test, both my examiner and my instructor said that they were really surprised that I wanted to go today, considering all the turbulence and the choppy air. And at that point, you know, I didn't really have the mindset that it was my decision to make. I was kind of going along with the program. So I wasn't exactly sure that I could just say, oh, yeah, I don't want to go today or I want to discontinue at this point. I grew those kind of legs later on. And I actually did discontinue a check ride later on because of that kind of weather based on that experience. But at the time, I thought, you know, hey, well, I'll just go. You know, I have to go now since I already finished your oral exam. So the flying portion of the exam started off pretty normal. I got a little flustered in the beginning. The examiner asked me to go to a certain checkpoint, gave me a clearance to a certain checkpoint, and I wrote down the clearance and read that back to him correctly, just like you would for air traffic control. And then I started to program some things in the GPS to help me get set up for my first approach, because they're all going to be basically based off this one navigational aid. And I wanted to set it up in a flight plan so I could go direct to it. And I think some of it was my misunderstanding of how the GPS navigator in the aircraft worked. I'm kind of a pro at it now. I love it now. But at the time, I was still just kind of learning all the little tricks there. And I started to program some stuff in, and he comes over the intercom and says, "What are you doing?" And I immediately started to panic because I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know why I was setting it up that way. And if I thought about it for a minute, which I eventually did, I thought, well, I could just hit direct to this point and then I can activate all my approaches from there. And I eventually remembered that I could do that in those few seconds and said, oh, I'm just going to this waypoint. And then he didn't say anything after that. So I just thought to myself, oh, great. Now I've really screwed this up. I've already set a bad impression. So we taxi out to the runway and he tells me to go direct to this waypoint that he's given me, this navigational aid. And I take off and we put the view limiting device on, or foggles as some people would call them, and started doing things like, you know, climbing altitude and holding, and then just holding that altitude, not actually holding, but holding that altitude. And then he would take the controls and put me in unusual attitude and had to correct for that. And we did that a couple of times. And then he said, okay, you can proceed, you know, back direct to, you know, whatever nav aid it was. And he said, I'll be air traffic control. And you can just talk to me like you're talking to air traffic control. And of course, beforehand, he briefed and he said, hey, if I'm not talking or I'm not telling you that you're doing anything wrong, you're doing fine. And I don't know if I forgot that or something, but I always thought that I was doing horribly. It actually started going very well. And I went through and he told me to shoot my first approach. And it happened to be a VOR approach into a small airport, and it had to be timed. And so I thought, well, at least I'll get the hardest one out of the way, because the other two I knew were going to be a GPS approach and an ILS approach, because he'd already briefed the approaches that he was going to ask me to do ahead of time. So we go in and we do this VOR approach, and I set it all up, and I thought, hey, everything's going great. You know, I set my altitude minimums into the oral warning in the aircraft, so it would tell me when I got to my minimum approach altitude. So it would tell me when I got to the minimum altitude for that approach, and everything was kind of all set up. The clock was set up. Everything was good. I actually activated the clock a little bit too late, so I just said, okay, well, that was about 10 seconds late, so I'm going to add 10 seconds to that. And he was fine with all that. Everything was going fine. Got through that approach. Told him when I got to a missed approach point that I didn't see the runway environment. And he said, okay, proceed direct to Liberty VOR and get ready for your next approach. And so I went direct to Liberty VOR, and then he gave me instruction for the next approach. So the next approach happened to be a GPS approach, and we have WAAS. And so it was an LPV approach, localize air performance with vertical guidance, for those who don't know. It basically gives you a glide slope like an ILS approach would give you. Not the same as an ILS approach. It's not a precision approach or considered a precision approach, but it does give you that glide slope. So I proceeded on the approach and everything was going fine. Although, like I said, it was very, very bumpy and very, very difficult to hold altitude and stay on course. But I was seemed to be doing well with that. He didn't say anything about it anyway. Started programming the approach and was briefing the approach and put in the minimums for the approach into the primary flight display. It's a G500 for those who are not familiar with the system. It's kind of like a single screen G1000. It's split down the middle. So you have a PFD and MFD of sorts all on one screen. And there's a spot where you can put in the minimums for your approach so that when you approach that altitude, it will come over your intercom and tell you minimums. I thought, well, this is the greatest thing ever because I don't have to remember what the minimums anymore are. I can plug them into there and then I can kind of just focus on the flying, which is great. And I'm sure that's why it was there. So I started the approach. Everything was going well. Doing my checklist. Came down to the final approach fix and started my descent. And I got down to about 1,200 feet, I believe it was. I can't remember the exact altitude, but I remember very clearly the warning saying minimums in my ear. And I immediately say, minimums, runway not in sight, going missed. And I pushed the throttle in and started to climb. The next thing I hear from the right seat is, take your foggles off. And I just thought, oh, okay, this can't be good. So I took my foggles off. He's like, look outside. And I looked out, and there's the runway in front of me. And it is very, very far below me. And he said, where are you right now? I said, well, I'm pretty high. He said, yeah, what is the minimums for that approach? And I looked down at my chart, and I said that they were 866 feet. And he said, what's your altitude now? And I said, it's 1,200 feet. He says, so why are you there? And immediately said, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to issue a disapproval for this certificate. Do you want to continue? And I think at that point, my heart just sank. Like, I was completely done. I probably shouldn't have continued to fly the check ride at that point because I was so flustered. I couldn't believe that I just made a mistake that was worthy of failing my check ride, and not just a check ride, but my first check ride in 10 years and the first check ride of this new path I decided to come down. So, you know, all these thoughts going through my head of, well, you know, is this the way the rest of this program is going to go? Or am I going to be unsuccessful at every check ride now? And then I realized what had happened after I thought about it for a few seconds. I went into the PFD to enter in the barrel minimums for the approach. And it was so bumpy that day that when I went to enter them, it actually cleared them out. And instead of just clearing them out to zero or turning them off, it made them the minimums for the previous approach that I had in. So it reverted back to the old ones, which makes sense because, you know, if you made a mistake and go back, it put in the ones you had before. But I didn't see that. And I didn't pay attention to it. And the real fatal error there was that I was relying on this automation of sorts to remember the things that I should have remembered or briefed or had available to me at the time. And that's what caused me to be unsuccessful. And in reality, yes, going missed at a higher altitude rather than a lower altitude is probably safer, but it's also not appropriate. So if you could have broken through the clouds, let's say you're low on fuel, and you could have broken through the clouds, but you didn't because you went to the wrong altitude and you ran out of fuel and crashed, that would have been pretty bad. So I had a lot of people say, well, he shouldn't have failed you for that. That wasn't unsafe and, you know, that kind of thing. Well, the point is that he needed me to fly the approach the way it was written. And it was written to fly it down to the certain altitude, and I didn't do that. And like I explained before, if I'd been low on fuel and had not broken through the clouds and not been able to land and tried to go missed and circle to another runway or go to another approach at another airport, ran out of fuel because I did something incorrect, it'd still be my fault. So I think it was certainly very appropriate. And I didn't feel good about it at the time, but I know why the examiner had to do that. And I understand the point he was trying to make. And not that he was making a point, but he was following his rules, and the rules say you got to fly it the way it's written. So I elected to continue because it had kind of been beaten into my head that I should probably just go ahead and continue the check ride, even if it was unsuccessful, just to try to get any remaining requirements done, so that I wouldn't have to repeat too much stuff later on. So I said, yeah, I'll go ahead and continue the check ride. And that ended up being a mistake as well. I was already way too flustered to, think of everything that was going on at the time. And he kind of gave me vectors back around for another approach, and we're going to do a partial panel approach. And he gave me an approach to a runway, and I think I wasn't just situationally aware because of everything was going through my head. And he told me I was cleared for this other GPS approach, and it was a partial panel approach. So he actually failed some of my instruments, which allowed me to not have a glide slope, which would increase my minimums on the approach to the LNAV minimums, which are a little bit higher because you don't have vertical guidance anymore. You only have lateral navigation. So he failed my instruments, and then he cleared me for a circling approach. So here I go down. Now I'm flying the approach. And again, I'm tracking everything perfectly as far as the route goes and things like that. And I'm flying partial panel now. I've got some of my instruments failed, and I'm only flying off of one of the secondary GPSs and using my backup attitude indicator and such. And he asked me what the minimums for the approach were, and I told him what they were, and he was like, that's wrong. And I said, no, it was this, it was LPV minimums, and then when you failed these instruments, it went down to LNAV minimums, and now I have to fly these minimums. He said, no, you're wrong. I don't think you're understanding what's going on here. I think we have a problem. And then we landed, and we sat and talked about it for a bit, and then I realized what was going on is that through all my frustration and everything, I didn't hear him clear me for the circling approach, and I was flying the LNAV minimums because I was also partial panel. So instead of doing the circling minimums, which would have stayed the same whether I was partial panel or not, I flew to the LNAV minimums or attempted to fly to the LNAV minimums, and it was just another thing that went wrong that day. I definitely attribute that to me being so out of the situation and not thinking clearly about what was going on. But I think that it definitely taught me a lesson. I definitely learned a lot. I learned a lot about not relying on automation. I learned a lot about fixing your mistakes and moving forward and not getting discouraged. I came back the next week, and he was very polite about everything. You know, he said, you know, you flew really, really well. Your oil was fantastic. We just had that problem. I cannot pass you with those issues. And he said, you know, come back next week and we'll get you on the schedule and we'll do it again. You'll get another shot at it. And, you know, I was really beat up at that point. I was super frustrated. And my instructor, it was almost funny. He came up to me after we landed, and he was like, hey, man, hey, congratulations. How'd it go? And I said, no, it's not good. He's like, what are you talking about? I said, no, it didn't go well. I failed. And he just couldn't believe it because he'd seen me through training. He knew that I was up to the task. He just couldn't believe that I'd made a mistake and not passed. I think we both thought that I was going to be perfectly fine that day. And it was shocking to him as it was to me. And I think that's probably going to be true with any instructor who's doing their job, because if they sign someone off for a check ride, they should expect them to pass because that's kind of the requirement, right? But he expected me to pass for sure. And there was no doubt in his mind about it. And it just kind of threw a curveball to him. So he wasn't upset. He was very supportive. He kept telling me it was okay. You know, it's fine. We'll get retrained. We'll get it done. I was a mess. Like, I didn't even want to fly back. I was like, you can fly. I'll run your radios for you or something like that. I just didn't want to do it. So we flew back and scheduled a check ride. And, you know, lo and behold, we went to the check ride next week and I passed with flying colors, didn't have an issue. He didn't say a word to me the whole time. We flew the two approaches I needed to fly, and that was the end of it. And I was a new instrument rated pilot. But I definitely learned a lot about that through that experience. And the funny thing is that experience keeps coming up. I talk to my students about it all the time. I hate the fact that I failed a check ride. And it's the only one. It's the only one I've ever failed. And I hate the fact that I failed a check ride. But I also believe that it makes me a better pilot, a better aviator in the long run, because I know that I am fallible, that I can make mistakes, and that I will never make that particular mistake again, because it was so detrimental to everything I was doing. It affected me so much that I will always think about that. And whenever I look at a line of minima on an approach chart, it's always burned in my brain about that experience, because it affected me so much. And I think that's a good thing. I think that, you know, having that experience will keep me from doing those things in the future. So naturally, after instrument, I kind of plugged along and I went through and got my multi-engine commercial and then single, and then went to CFI school. And we've talked about that a little bit down in Jacksonville, Florida. That's a long process, but finished all that stuff up. Instead of deciding to instruct for ATP, I decided I wanted to go back home and try to instruct here. Also the president of the Cape Fear Flying Club in the area. And my initial thought was to just instruct for the flying club, for anybody who might want to learn to fly through the club. That didn't work out very well. Just not enough traffic through the doors really keep me interested. Every now and then I still do some instruction for them for checkouts and do flight reviews for members and things like that, but nothing real crazy. But eventually decided to go across the field to a new flight school that had just opened up recently and ask if they needed any flight instructors. And turns out they did. And there was only two flight instructors working there currently. And I was the third that came on. And I think it's been a little over a year now that I've been instructing with that particular flight school. And I think we have probably a dozen instructors on the schedule, probably eight or so airplanes on the schedule. And it's been quite busy. So I was glad to be there kind of at the beginning of it of sorts. They'd actually been there for a little while before I got there, but just with a couple of instructors. So it was kind of cool to watch them grow from what they started out to what they are now, and see some of the changes that have been going on, new airplanes coming in, the different students coming in, watching the wall of solo t-shirts grow to not just a wall, but all the way down the hallway, and then see some of my own students' t-shirts and things up there too, and watch them pass their check rides and stuff. And to this point now that, you know, I'm a Gold Seal flight instructor, which doesn't mean anything terribly important. I take a lot of pride in it. That's important to me. But for those who don't know, to become a Gold Seal flight instructor, you have to be active in flight instruction, and you have to send a certain number of people to go take practical tests for certificates. And those people who take those practical tests have to have a certain amount of success. So you have to have 80% or better success rate, and you have to have sent at least 10 people off for a check ride in the previous 24 calendar months. So I had quite a bit more than that, actually, and quite a bit higher than 80%. I think I only had one person who was unsuccessful one time, and that was a learning experience for myself as well. just like everything. But I'm very proud of that fact. And I'm very proud to have that gold seal on my flight instructor certificate now. So if you are a flight instructor and you've been thinking about going to get that, try to strive for that, because it definitely sets you apart by having been that active and been that successful in teaching. And I really, really enjoy that. Looking toward the future, I have applied for an airline position with a regional airline. When I got to a certain number of hours, there was a cadet program of sorts where you're basically a trainee, very, very close to finishing by the time the coronavirus thing hit and everything kind of been put on hold. Still part of the program, not really sure what the future holds for that program or for that airline or, you know, for my future as an aviator. As a commercial pilot, I enjoy instructing. I'm happy to keep instructing. So that's not a huge deal to me. I know it's hurting a lot of people who had their sights set on the airlines for a long time. So, you know, not trying to diminish that at all. But for me, I'm at a point in my life where I can do one or the other, and I enjoy instructing. But the interesting thing, it kind of comes full circle. When I applied for the airline, one of the things they ask you on the application or one of the applications is, have you ever failed a check ride? And of course, I had to relate this entire experience on a piece of paper again, and which I'll never forget. It's tough to write it down. It's a lot easier to talk about it, but it's certainly tough to write it down. And just talk about what I learned and things like that. And it didn't affect me at all. You know, if anything, I think they were looking to see that people who have failed a check ride didn't just blame it on somebody other than themselves or make excuses or try to say that someone's just out to get them. I think they just want to see honesty and see that you probably learned something from the experience. And that's what I did. And then I just related it the same way I related it to you all. And never had an issue with it after that. So I think that it didn't affect me whatsoever in that regard. And I'm still glad for the experience. I wish it didn't happen because it's not fun to say that. But it's good to tell your students sometimes, you know, if they're struggling with something or if they have failed a check ride, you can kind of relate to them and say, look, I've been there. I've done that. It sucks. I know plenty of people who have been through and never failed a check ride. And that's awesome, too. And I'm really happy for them and proud of them. And I'm so glad they didn't have to go through that experience. But sometimes I wish that some people knew what that felt like just so they would have a little bit of that experience to kind of relate back to their own students, especially when they're teaching. Because so many of my students, so many of our students think, oh, we can do everything. And, you know, we haven't been through that. And some of them haven't been through that. And I think people need to know that kind of struggle. So, but it's been a good experience. That's just a little bit about my background. I've had so many guests on recently talking about their background and flying and everything. I thought I'd share a little bit about that with you and certainly share that story about not being successful in a check ride and how that can affect you in the future and how you can learn from it and how you can grow from it. And just to know that it's not the end of the world, because I'm sure there's people out there who have failed check rides. There's plenty of people out there who have never failed a check ride, and I don't see it as a badge of honor, and I don't see it as a war wound necessarily either. I just see it as something that I learn from and I grow from. So today we are in the new studio that I've built in my house specifically for this purpose. I apologize for the podcast being a day or so late. We had some technical issues trying to get the sound correct in this space, but I'm super excited about it. It's going to allow me to have more people on in a more comfortable fashion than sitting in a spare bedroom. Looking forward to getting some more guests on for the next couple weeks, providing some more content for you guys out there. So again, thanks for joining us. We try to get new podcast episodes out every Friday. You can follow us at Wayward Pilot on Instagram. We're getting a website up, waywardpilot.com. That's still kind of in the works, but it's just going to have some links about topics in the show and links to where you can download the episodes there as well. For more information to contact me, you can email podcast@waywardpilot.com if you'd like to get in contact. If you've got a topic for the show, if you'd like to come on and be featured on the show, we'd love to talk to you. We always take questions from student pilots, so be sure to send those questions to podcast@waywardpilot.com, or you can direct message me on Instagram @waywardpilot. We'd love to have you talk on live on the show and record some of your responses and things like that. Again, thank you all for joining us, and we'll talk to you next week.
Your Wayward Pilot podcast flight has reached its final destination. Remember to follow at Wayward Pilot on Instagram and check waywardpilot.com for further resources and to connect with Jonathan and his team. We hope you'll fly with us again next week. Until then, subscribe, rate, and review.